How's that?
I think
one day
I feel so
well. Look, thank you.
Now, what would be my story if that were the case?
Oh no! So, that's not what I meant.
You can, but I can't answer it.
And there was this indescribable welter of emotions.
I think
to this day
I will never accept.
It was
that.
Like something that
never
just sort of snapped in my head.
And look, I don't know. It's a miracle.
And I hope that the people listening to us will enjoy what they hear.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello, I'm Richard Feidler. This week, we're presenting some of your favourite conversations from 2012. I watched an episode of Gardening Australia last night on iView, hosted by Costa Georgiadis, who is my guest today. Costa's got his whole neighbourhood in Sydney involved in creating a verge garden, right on what was a drab bit of grass on the nature strip. And Costa got a bunch of kids to draw something on a bunch of brown paper bags. He filled up each bag with mixed salad leaves from the verge, and he and the kids delivered one bag to every house in the street. And the thing was that no matter what age these people were or what their cultural background was, they were also genuinely delighted to get these leaves and they could find a use for them. And they were all going to put different uses to them as well. Costa Georgiadis loves this kind of thing because it's not just the planting and the growing. It's the socialising, the conversation, and the sheer absolute common sense involved in growing your own rather than getting in the car to buy something less fresh from the supermarket. In some ways, turning a suburban nature strip into a communal garden seems wildly unconventional, but then you think, it's only unconventional until it isn't. Costa Georgiadis, hello, sir.
That's a big start, Richard.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you think, well, why not? I mean, and why do we have these nature strips that are all the same? Well, pretty much the same throughout Australia. There seems to be no reason for it. It's just a thing I've got to mow each week, Costa.
Yeah, I think it's a leftover of the colonial hope and vision that we'd have these rolling grass fields and our mansion castles sticking out of these grass fields. I mean, we don't live in that climate, and the grass is just an entropic nothingness. It's a blandness, and we could do so much more with it, not only visually, but environmentally, and then productively, more to the point.
How's your verge growing? And tell me what you're growing on it.
The verge is doing really well. I mean, we worked away at building the soil with a no-dig system, like loosen and manures and straws, and built it up by, you know, a good half a metre or more. So all the veggies have grown in this new lush creme brulee of composting sunlight.
Creme brulee of composting. Slightly less tasty, though.
yeah, well, tasty for the plants. But we got there's good stuff growing there. And being an early project, it was important that we grew stuff that could give quick result. You know, a lot of people start off with tomatoes and they're difficult. Like, start with lettuce greens, they grow. You add sunlight, some moisture and some soil and lettuce greens grow. So we've got things like multi-pick lettuces from oaks to cos. We've got chicories and endives, the bitter stuff.
Yeah, they're great.
And I love that whole concept of bringing more balance into our whole taste regime. Everything is so sweet and salty. We need the bitter. And then even the furry. We need the furry.
What's the furry?
And we're not talking about the beard. Well, you think of okra. Okra's furry. It's got that fur on it, but we're not growing okra there yet. But dandelion. Most people have been conditioned to think it's a weed when it's actually an incredible medicine that is one of the colonizers. It's one of the first plants that comes and says, I'll find whatever trace minerals are here. I'll get in there and find them. And dandelion root has been a medicinal plant for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah, I'm watching the show with my wife, who's, you know, Singaporean extraction. She goes, oh, dandelion's fantastic. I said, is it? No one's ever told me this before.
Yeah, you can have like dandelion tea and it's got a beautiful licorice-y flavour. But in this case, the dandelion leaves, we could do two things with them. You can throw them straight into the salad or you can just steam them and have them as like a veggie. And the Greeks do it, you know, olive oil, vinegar, a bit of lemon, and you just have that. And there's the balance. There's that bitterness. So we've got that growing. We had some, we had one bean. My bean crop was very successful. I got a bean.
Did you get that bean or someone else got the bean?
Yeah, Mr. Bean. But good to have failures as well, because I don't want this as some happy, happy story that's just fantastic because it's on TV.
No, gardens are garden. It's not a fable, is it? No.
And it is real, and it's required an effort. I mean, going around and talking to all the neighbours and getting people aware of what's going on, that took time. I mean, because you can't just sort of tap on the door. Oh, g'day, Richard. I'm going to plant a garden up on my street. Yep, okay, thanks, mate. See ya. I ended up spending a couple of weeks going around each night, and I'd get through three or four people over 4 hours by the time, because it's about building the community context. And of course, I missed a couple of people, and they had their doubts, and they've got their concerns now, and you know, it goes to show you got to make that effort.
Has it been successful in building trust in your street?
Unbelievable.
Like how?
There's families down the end of the street. They come up for a walk every couple of nights. Just the family and the kids. No phones, no toys, no nothing, maybe a scooter. And they just walk up, shoot the breeze, have a chat, get up there, have a dose of amazement that the veggies have grown a bit more. So that alone, if I had to write out success or not success, just that alone is amazing. We've now got families sending their kids up to put their veggie scraps in the bucket outside my place, which we feed to the chickens. And what's happened more recently is a couple of the younger siblings are now coming up on their own without their older siblings. So it's kind of building this street trust. Everyone knows. They see the kids walking up. Oh, you're taking the scraps up to the chickens. Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, grab a couple of leaves on your way home. And other things like cars swing around the corner. Parents and kids' necks are going wink as they come around the corner. They're going, look at it this week. And people pull up and they chat. People are standing there. I hear chatter under the window and people are just walking past and going, oh, look at this now and look at that. I mean, that alone, if we didn't harvest a thing, if it was just purely a visual experiment illustrating how your very sustenance grows, if I put a Perspex over it and people just watched it as a window and didn't take anything, I'd say it's been incredibly successful after 8 weeks.
One of the things I like about what you're doing is that even what you're doing is, I suppose, on the face of it to many people, something that's it's young, it's interesting, it's new, it's different, unconventional. It's something that my grandparents would have completely recognised and be utterly familiar with, this whole process of making a garden, growing things on it, having chooks in the backyard, doing all of that.
They all had it. Take it back to the Victory Gardens. The Victory Gardens were a legacy for people to have it, but it tended to be a patch out the back. What I'm loving about this whole project is I'm saying, no one goes out back. Let's put it out the front. Let's put it on the street. So, I mean, the kids walk past on their way to school every day, and it's like, in their face, have a look at this. Costa, when can we have something? No, not yet. Oh, can we have something? No, not yet. Just wait a little while. Another week. Oh, can we have some? All right, let's just break some off, give it a wash and have it. And you get kids eating mustard leaves. You put a mustard leaf on a plate and the kid bites the first bit, they'll spit it out and just go, yuck. When they've been watching this thing and they've built a relationship with it, they bang it down and say, oh, that's spicy, can I have some more? So you know, it's a project, but what I also like about it is, from a change-making point of view, it gives the opportunity to put it out there and say, why not? This is building community without a program, without sort of, oh, we've got to institute this, and we've got to gazette that, and we've got to put funding here, and we've got to do that. This is just happening with some simple seedlings on existing land, with some input of manures and things, and this is building community. When I had the chickens in the little chicken tractor on the street, they were coming, families were just sitting there next to the chicken tractor and the kids watching the chickens. But the beauty is, while your kids are sitting there looking at the chickens, another adult or family comes by and you say, oh, hello, I'm Richard. Oh, what number are you? Oh, you're 27. Oh, I'm down at number 11. People have met people.
Tell me why you'd like to see councils employ goat herders.
Oh, this is an easy one. Back to the context of lawn, large expanses of lawn. Look, I don't have a problem with lawn, don't get me wrong, for fields and certain, a nice piece of lawn is a good thing to have and to come out on. But when you have acres and acres of it through our streets that isn't lawn, that's just basically a weed patch that has to be maintained by a local organisation, and they have to rationalise it, and it's very expensive, and they've got crews that go out there and then constantly looking for shortcuts. So how do we do the edging? Well, let's spray the edges so that then if we spray them, then we don't have to do them every couple of months. We can do them every 4 or 5 months. But stop for a second. Just step back and say, we're spraying our streets. Our streets are our home. We're putting a toxic chemical over, well, it's more than just the length of the street because it's four sides of every nature strip. We're spraying with chemicals. And then our kids come out and walk barefoot to the car and then they walk around, they play cricket and they do all these things. So you just think, it's actually a headache. Councils have got this problem. We've got to look after these things. Well, why can't we think outside the square? Imagine having goats. And so instead of these poor guys having to be on brush cutters with earmuffs all day, you know, soul-destroying work, imagine just having goats, a little bit of solar-powered electric fencing. They put it up around the thing. He holds his cane, reads the paper, and then behind them he brings the chickens, which then chew up the manure and spread it, and then he collects the eggs and can give them out to the people in the street. The grass gets mowed, it gets fertile, it actually gets absorbent, which will then take in the moisture from the next rains, not be just this hydrophobic sand that sheds the water with all the waste that's sitting there and the manure, dog poo and whatever else, into the gutter, into the creeks and do all that damage. Here we could suddenly turn it around, actually have, I mean, imagine that. You look in the on the web or in the phone book and it says, you know, such and such council, goat herding supervisor.
Yeah.
Why not?
Well, it just occurred to me thinking about this, if you flipped it round and if that was the norm, if teams of goats were brought around to trim the edges and the council said, okay, ratepayers, we're changing next week. We're going to shift to a system where some guy's going to walk around with a canister and spray a toxic chemical to keep the edges of the lawn. There'd be community outrage, wouldn't there? So that, you just flip that round.
I love the way you flip that because it just sort of says, yeah, it's only as acceptable as we make it. And if we accept it, it'll just keep happening. So, no, I love that thinking.
What kind of practical pets do you have around your place, Costa?
I probably have about 2,000 worms. And they're...
You're not pets, though. They won't sit on your lap.
No, they won't. Yeah, although, you know, when I do feed them and that, I take a few out and I show them to the kids when they come up. I actually had some people here the other day. He was here from Mexico and he's right into the latest in compost and humus building. But I lifted the lid and you could hear my pets. They were going, I'll have to tape it and send you a recording of worms at work. You could have a little sign up there, worms at work. So I got my worms, but I've got five chickens.
Five girls. Hello, girls, you'd say.
Yeah. Hello, girls. Yeah, exactly. They're fantastic. They prepare all my garden beds. I now have permission to take them out onto the street and prepare garden beds where I need to in their little tractor. And I share the eggs with people. And kids come up and they put their scraps in this bin. And from time to time, they'll lift the bin up and there's some eggs in there. So it's nice to be able to sort of teach them that cycle, that their scraps become eggs and their eggs become scraps.
How did you nurse one of your girls back to health?
Well, my cousin had a couple of chickens and a rooster and it was in the heart of town. And of course, the neighbours weren't too happy about the rooster. And they got rid of the rooster and then one of the chickens died. And so the other one was pretty upset and it was just staying in and it got an infection and they call it sour crop, where it gets an infection in its
throat. Is that the word? Or the wattle?
And basically it just stinks. And he bought this chicken over and it didn't have a name at the time. He bought this chicken over. I could smell it from the street and he opened the box. I almost fell over and he said, oh, it's not eating. And I was like, oh, I said, and it was grey. And so I spoke to a friend of mine and he said, yeah, that's sour crop. And we said, okay, yogurt. So I put yogurt and honey. And that's all I put out for it for about 3 weeks. And the yogurt got the bacteria going again. She's back in voice. And it turned out that her name is Stinky. So Stinky's cool. She's back on deck.
Where does this passion begin for you, Costa? Who gave you this passion?
It's funny. I've been asked this a few times. And look, outwardly and initially, without doubt, it came from my grandfather. Well, I mean, my grandfather was a market gardener. He first came to the country back in the late 20s after fleeing Greece after the war. He went to Florida and then to Cuba and then jumped on a boat and came to Australia, which is quite an amazing story. And when he met my grandmother, they were in Queanbeyan and then they moved out to Ningen, which is, you know, out
past Dubbo,
yeah. Bourke. They had a farm out there and Dad grew up there and he and his brothers and sisters used to work on the farm collecting all the veg. And then there was the drought in the 40s and they literally had to walk off the land and they came to Sydney. And so
they just had to walk off the land or just walk away from their property?
Just walk away. Like there was no water. There was, you couldn't grow anything. It was just, it had been 8 years and they literally walked off and came to town.
Oh, what? That must have killed them to do that. Look, all I'm the sure work that must, and the labour must.
Yeah.
And then to walk away, that's hard for country people, isn't it?
Yeah. And he came to Sydney and had a huge backyard just near Centennial Park. And that's where my connection began. And he was just so into it. There was not a square millimetre of ground without production. That's where it began. That's where my connection with the soil began. He just loved to grow this food as much as he loved to give it to my grandmother, who loved so much to prepare it and give it to us. My grandfather grew it so proudly and he shared it and got so much back. So he was giving, but he was getting more in return. And my grandmother would cook and she wouldn't want to eat it. She'd want you to eat it. And that same principle of giving and sharing came through my dad. And my dad is such a perfectionist. He instilled that, you know, if you're going to do something, you be proud of it and you do it right. And if it's got to be level, it's level. And if you're going to fix something, you fix it properly. And you don't do it at 50% or 60%. And, you know, I mean, and growing up, that was tough because he was tough. You do something, you go, no, that's not good enough. You know, I think about who I am now and to get where I want to go and to be what I want to be, they're the things that have given me the, not just the foundation, but that ongoing focus to look at a situation, no matter what it is, whether it's a conversation or whether it's a little problem or a question that someone's asked, to actually get to it and go, right, what is the issue here? Cut to it, cut sharp, cut neat and go for it. And then sprinkle on the top of that the fact that my mum was amazing because she just had such a memory and an ability to connect the real soulful side of things. Like if she knew your birthday was the 28th of May, you would get a card as a friend, as a family friend, as a cousin, she wouldn't have to look in the book. And I think from a family point of view, she was so incredibly aware of everyone's feelings. She knew how to bracket important points to give you that lift and that self-belief. There's an interesting line between feeling important but also recognizing that you're not that important, that, you know, 2 days from now, if I'm no longer the host of Gardening Australia, well, someone else is going to do it, right? And things will move on. So that makes me realize that if I am going to do something, you got to make it good now, because it's the now. It's not down the track, and join those dots and join them well.
So with this Greek culture of growing and cooking and sharing, did you have language as well?
Yeah, had Greek language. Used to speak it with my grandparents and other relatives. At home, per se, like in our immediate family, like with my mum and dad and my sisters, we spoke English, but we spoke Greek with others.
Did that come in handy later in life?
I would rate that as one of the most important tools that I have in my kit, because it gives you another way of thinking, and it also opens you up to another whole cultural way of thinking. And you know, when you can sort of say, oh, there's a word that you can't say in English but you can say it in Greek. I mean, unfortunately I got a few languages, but that was because I learnt Greek. And I realized this at a young age when I went on this exchange program in year 9, and I realized that I was over there ringing my friends, relatives, and saying, Richard is here from Australia, Uncle Manoli, and Richard wants to come and see you. And then we'd go there and I was translating. And I remember I came home and I said thank you to my mum and dad for making me learn, because that was a tool that is much harder to buy later because you learnt it so easily. And having those lessons just knocked it into shape. And then I went on and I learnt French at school, and then I did it also at uni. And then when I went and I lived in Europe, and I learnt how to speak German because I was living in Austria, and then I went to Czech, and by being there, and when you've got languages on board, you just get it and you get it quicker. It opens up a richness of exchange and the world's people. I just love it. I love that, you know, I'd walk in there to have some lunch before I came here, and, you know, there's the guys doing the gardens down there on South Bank. Hey, you know, hello, how are you, and what's going on, and what's your story? Stories make it important. The other stuff you can learn.
So when does gardening become a life for you, or something you want to actually do as the core thing in your life, Costa?
I didn't know what I wanted to do when I finished school. Like when I finished school and people go, oh, you got to get your marks and all this, I was like, oh, but what do I want to do? And then someone said, oh, why don't you be a lawyer like your uncle? And then someone said, what about an electrician? And I didn't really want to be an electrician like that.
You wanted
that.
Something to engage your idealism, didn't you?
Yeah, I think possibly. So. I think so. And I was like, anyway, I'll do arts because I just sort of scraped in to uni, just did enough and got in on arts. So I got in, did subjects I enjoyed, and then lo and behold, midway through the term, one of my best friends, he said, oh, I'm thinking of transferring to this course called Landscape Architecture. And he gave me the form. And I said, oh, give me a look at that. I think we were sitting on the library lawn at UNSW and one lunchtime, you know, the long lunches. And I read this thing and I go, oh, you know, design and learn about natural systems, hydrology, geography, climate. Oh, that's interesting. Learn about plants and gardens and blah, blah. And I thought, geez, I said, I might read up a bit more on that. That was it. That was the moment. That was the turning point. And I looked at that and I went down to the professor and I said, hey, what do I have to do to get in here? And he said, just get good marks and come down and see me in November. And I did, and that was kind of like the door in. Then I got into that course. I loved it, but I was just hungry. I just wanted more information. I was studying catchment management. I was going off and doing aquaculture. I'd finished a permaculture course.
So then you went off to Europe and spent much of the 90s in Europe. You were in Czechoslovakia not long after the Velvet Revolution there, in Austria.
I was actually. I was really lucky. Let's take that back. Luck is your own doing, really, and it's about focusing more on the clean windscreen than what's coming, because then you'll see it, you know. And I went over there and I was just free, and it was something that I wanted to do from the time I got back from that Greece trip. It was just an amazing freedom, and at the same time I was around and in a country that and in an entire country that was experiencing a new freedom. I was talking to people that were the same age as me that weren't allowed the same privileges that I'd had. And I almost felt, wow, I haven't recognized how precious that is. Talking to beautiful people our age who are actually scared to say something to you in public. We were trying to buy something and a girl was standing next to us in the queue and she said, oh, and she could speak some English. And we did our transaction. Then we went outside and we just said, oh, thank you. And she was really scared to talk to us, to be seen socializing with us out of what she's grown up with. We've got so much, and it takes that opportunity to go away and come back and say, well, yeah, I've got to make the most of this.
What kind of work were you doing while you were there?
I ended up getting a job helping this beautiful old man fix up his garden hut, fix the floor on it. And then in that time, I ended up getting a job with a landscape design and construction company, and I travelled all over Austria and Bavaria building these amazing eco ponds and rooftop gardens and experienced a world of environmental awareness that was really 20 years ahead of us.
20 years ahead of Australia. Yeah. In what way?
Energy over there is such a big thing. When you have freezing cold winters, you need energy and you understand energy differently. Here, we've never had to understand it because we've gone, oh, there's a big hole with coal. Let's just dig it up and burn it and we'll be sweet forever. So we've just taken it for granted.
So the fact that Europe's been living with a sense that resources are finite and need to be brought in from elsewhere, that's why they're a bit further down the track?
Totally. And you had the Austrians incredibly paranoid and anxious about the fact that there was old nuclear power stations dotted just across the border in the former East and thinking, well, if one of them blows,
it doesn't matter what we've done,
you know. There was an incredible recycling awareness, an incredible, like I was working with a company that composted like municipally and did all this stuff, which we've just been getting into more recently. I mean, 20 years is probably a bit extreme, but I would comfortably say they were doing stuff at least 15 years ahead.
But you came back to Australia and it was family that brought you back, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I loved it over there. I just found my niche and living there in the centre of Europe. I was in Prague every weekend or in Czech Republic. I'd be in Hungary and Budapest. I'd get a train to Paris. Vienna's incredibly central. But, you know, I came back and wanted to be here with my family. I had a few friends' weddings and things on. And then, because I had quite a few years where I'd come home in December and then go back to Europe at the end of February when the ground would thaw. So I had a few years without a winter. Coming back here to family was important. You know, we were getting the next generation going in the family. My sisters were having kids and I hadn't met them and, you know, I wanted to be a part of that and that kind of brought me back.
Your mum died and you moved in with your dad after that. And you're still with your dad today?
Yeah. There was a patch there where you know, some things happened. And I suppose you look at those experiences and those times in your life where you lose someone, and again, it just strengthens those reasons I talked about earlier in terms of, well, whatever you're doing, and if you're doing it, it's got to be for the now, because nothing is permanent, and you understand how precious life is, and that's what fuels my take on the world. You know, how precious, you know, our family members are, how precious our kids are, and like how precious our health is. And I suppose that's what motivates me to be so excited and keen about the importance of eating well and growing well, because then that fuels it all.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler.
With me in conversation is Costa Georgiadis, the host of Gardening Australia on ABC TV. On your TV show, one of the things I really love what you do, Costa, is when you built your verge in your suburb, you honoured the elders of the street. You bring in the kids and you honour the elders. That seemed to be a thing you're really careful to do. And they must have been pretty chuffed by that too, because it's very easy to overlook older people in Australia.
Yeah, I'm amazed that we've still got, you know, the street went through a change in the 80s. Where all of a sudden was that whole era of building and let's do a renovation and let's put a garage door right to the boundary.
Property prices and went right up, didn't they? Right up.
Yep. Through the roof. Mm. The big double garage right across the whole facade of the street. And suddenly what we knew as kids playing, and we could kick a footy and it would actually go in and hit the front of the house, now there was just a canyon. And it changed the street, because then people just drive on in and they hit the button from four houses away and they glide under this door and then you never meet them.
It's sad, isn't it? That double front garage on the street is pretty unfriendly, isn't it?
It's a community killer. You'll love this. For series 17, well, no, I won't go that far. So, I won't go put it that far. Let's say if this is series one that I'm doing, let's say in series two or three, I'd love to go down the street with a little excavator, if you want to talk about building community, and just rip those doors off, because they create courtyards of shade and nothingness just for the car. The car dominated the street. So it changed the street. But believe it or not, there's still some elders living in our street. Like original people that I remember from my childhood. And they're really one of the best assets of the street next to the kids. I'd rate the two extremes as the best. And somehow we spend this life bouncing like a pinball down the pinball machine between the youth stage and the elder stage. And I love the mix of them both. And I want to bring those two together, because that's what fuels me. I love the wisdom of the elders. And I love the excitement and boundless vitality of the youth. And you put those two together and you can create some amazing results.
Do you find the kids are really practical to have for gardening? Because kids see things that you miss, because they're used to looking at really tiny things that I just don't see.
You're spot on. And even bigger things, like they'll ask questions. And you're kind of busy looking at it saying, oh, well, we're good. Because we tend to think ahead. And the kids are just going like, right there. Well, yeah. Why have you done that? And why have you done this? And they come and there was one particular bit in the show last week where, and it was great that it was in the piece to camera that went to air, because I said, oh, okay, well, that's all done. And one of the little girls, she said, no, I'm not. And it's just nice, because they speak the truth. They speak what they feel. And you know, I suppose that's the point to answer your question. It's about the feel. And the elders have a feel that's been developed over 70, 80, 90 years. And the kids have a feel that's like right now, like, oh, that hurts me, you know, and they haven't learnt how to build firewalls and hide their feelings and bite their upper lip and sort of say, oh, well, I'll just say the right thing. That's where it's at. It's that mix between those two, the beautiful wealth and the rich aged approach of the elders and just that raw, I don't like this of the kids, or I love this and I want to get that hose and wet everyone, let them do it.
You're the godfather to how many kids?
Six.
Six kids. And I know you looked after your sister's kids for some years after she died at a young age, unfortunately. Bringing up kids, it's not a million miles different from gardening, is it? Not a million miles different.
Nice one.
Slow transformation.
Nice one. Yes. That's really well put. I actually said that, you know, I'm so excited about what I'm doing on Gardening Australia. I want to do so much, but I just got to be patient with it. And I just realized that, you know, as long as I just get the vocabulary in there, it's the vocabulary and the dialogue that's so important. And we were talking about one of the families and I was explaining their courtyard. I had to say to the camera, well, this is their courtyard and this is what it's about. And to put it in context, I just said, you know, Ellis and Mimi are growing a family. But that's only a little thing, but it washes over. And then you think about what they're doing, and that's exactly what they're doing. And what we did was help them grow some plants to help them grow their family. So, yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly that kids are so important, and our role model responsibility is phenomenal. And I spend a lot of time with kids. I'm heavily involved with my local school. And, you know, to me, there's no higher editorial policy than having kids, because you're on all the time. Whatever you say and whatever you do is under record button. And, you know, from my point of view, in my role as a teacher, as an educator, whatever you want to call it, as a presenter, as just a role model, that means you're on all the time. So, you know, that kind of role model thing, it doesn't end. Like, it doesn't stop and start, because it's like, oh, the camera comes on. As soon as the camera turns off, I return to my trailer. There is no trailer for me. If I'm walking down the street and someone says hello, or if I bump into kids that I used to referee and they go, oh, you know, I used to ref me in 96. I went to, you know, Waverley, or you used to ref me in the state championships at Eastwood. I had someone come up to me yesterday and they said, oh, you know, you used to referee me. I used to. And it's not to say that we have to be perfect, far from, but if we understand that, you know, mistakes happen that things aren't always right, as long as that example for the kids is a true example, well then, you know, they're growing and like the influence, like one thing that I might have said at the school today could click perhaps in 6 months, 6 years or 15 years when a kid's sitting there filling out their form to go to university or to further study, and they go, oh, I remember that half man, half hedge dude that came and talked about the importance of soil. And, you know, that's the value. I'm not saying that everything I say has value. I think there's probably a lot of compost in there too.
But in coming front from of the half man, half hedge, it's going to just have that much more weight to it, I think. It's clearly more sincere.
Yeah.
The man who is himself becoming a herbaceous border is clearly one who needs to be listened to on these matters.
Yeah, I that's it. You know, like I think the kids' side of things is just a wonderful opportunity to just. I mean, they give me more inspiration than I give them. I think I'll put it that way.
Now, you are a rugby
referee.
This is something you find is not that dissimilar from gardening, insofar as it kind of brings upon a kind of a lovely, peaceful state of mind for you, does it? Tell me how that happens in rugby.
Yeah, most people would think, yes, you are mad because they're on the sideline and there's noise and crowds screaming. They're doing it all day, Rick, get them outside. You know, blah, 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 the same old. But I go out there, keeps me fit. I stretch before the game. I can go out there and in that, whether the game is, you know, under 12s or under 15s or under 18s, for that 40, 60 or 80 minutes or 70 minutes, whatever the game is, when I'm there, that's all I'm thinking about. And in that same vein, as you said, when I'm in the garden, I'm just thinking about what I'm doing. And you don't have the phone and you don't have the disturbances and there's not the hassles.
Shopping list
and
you know, and the people, stuff you're supposed to do later today and all of that.
Yeah.
Yes.
And as strange as that seems, that, you know, I could be running around on a field with lots of people there watching the game, and I'm in this, like you say, a zen state of like, all I'm concentrating on, what's he done? How's he done? What's going on? Oh, that's not gone. That's a line out there. That's a this, that's a that. Penalty, rup-de-dup-de-da. Oops, that kid's trying to rip that one's head off. I'll just go over to him and say, look, nice tackle, but just keep it down. No need to pull cards here or anything. And what about you? Yeah, good tackle now. That's good. And all of a sudden, 70 minutes go by and I feel totally restfully fatigued.
Restfully fatigued. That's a beautiful state. It's a beautiful thing. So, Costa, that's one side of you that's not involved with the garden at all. The other one is music. Tell me about your role in the annual event known to the world as Beardstock. What is Beardstock and what do you do as part of Beardstock?
Beardstock. Beardstock was something that we had a band that we used to play with all of my good mates from school. Post-school, and it was called the More Please Orchestra. And in the year of, I think, the 30th anniversary of Woodstock, we were doing a show. And Sean, one of the producers on the show now, best buddy, he came up with the idea. I said, oh, we'll call it Beardstock for Woodstock. And then it just stuck. We did one. And then people said, when are you going to come back and do it again? And It's a crazy funk,
great bit of
disco
marketing.
Cabaret.
See, I don't even know what it is before you tell me, but I want to go to it.
The Beardstock.
I don't even have a beard, but I want to go to Beardstock. It just sounds like a good time.
It's a wonderful time. I mean, just imagine playing music with your best friends, and then you got a crowd full of people, of friends, and then it just grew and grew and grew. Initially, when we started, you know, I knew 98% of the people that came, and then as it grew and more people and bigger and blah blah blah, it sort of cut down, and you know, and there's lots of people bring their friends and friends and friends of friends who I don't know them all, but it's such music's such a incredible tool of comfort, of expression,
silliness,
relaxation, yeah, catharsis. Like with our band, we get up there and we do everything from Prince, Hot Chocolate, Chili Peppers, Cameo, Disco Inferno, like everything from disco to rock to funk. And there's just, I mean, life has lots of corners, and that's one corner that I cherish. You know, like if I had the chance to look at, you know, my life on a continuum, whilst they are not, there's not a large number of those events, they're like big chunks that I really enjoy. And, you know, music takes you back. Like we were talking earlier about Prague and my time in Europe, and I hear a song and it'll just, like, I hear an REM song, for example, and that's when I'm back there. Or, you know, I hear a Lenny Kravitz song, that's Vienna. I know, because I was driving a truck with a Bobcat down the A4, the A4, to get to, you know, Steel Town just outside of Vienna. And I love that, you know, you can see things and they bring back memories. You can hear music and it brings back memories. And I think the other powerful one is when you taste memories. You know, like I was in Bratislava, the southern capital of Slovakia. And I remember I went into this soup kitchen there at the time of the breakdown of the East Bloc, and they served some chicken, and the chicken was cooked exactly the same way that my grandmother had cooked it. And it was like I was sitting there with her, and it was just the smell and the taste. So yeah, music is a really valuable corner of my life.
I'm with Costa Georgiadis, the host of Gardening Australian. You've changed that show, or the show's changed with you. It's a different kind of show. It seems to make sense insofar as it's moved away from offering lots of technical information, because that's freely available to lots of people on the internet now. It seems to be more social now. It seems to be more about the process and people and the larger things and the stories that can come from the process of growing things in a garden. Is that the intent of the show now?
That's part that you picked it up. That is a big part of the intent. The stories bracket the information anyway. And the information can just be straight statistics, or it can be coming from a character that puts their angle and their love and their experience on it. And then all of a sudden everyone can relate to it. If it's straight statistics, well, like you say, you can get that anywhere. But when you have a 75-year-old man talking about the therapeutic power of gardening because he's needing some space to clear his mind from the pressures of looking after his wife that has dementia, that tells the story. And I mean, that tells the story straight to the heart. And that was probably, for me, made that whole last episode of the show and all the effort behind it of many, many people doing five stories with producers and executives and researchers and the whole team, the editors and the office staff, like doing an amazing thing to get five stories put together. But I look at it and I see that one point and that one comment providing comfort, support, and understanding to so many people that would be in that same boat and that don't get that opportunity to express it, whereas Fred expressed it for all those people. And the garden is a catalyst. So then we can have that on the show because it's the people that grow in the garden too.
And the friendships that come from that too, over-the-fence friendships. And yeah. There was a show on ABC TV that was shown not so long ago, and it was from the UK, and it was about a group of psychologists who go around treating people with food disorders. These are people who can only eat, for example, macaroni and cheese out of a box or something like that, and that's the only thing they can eat.
Jeez.
That and a packet of chips maybe. And, you know, they've got some serious malnutrition problems on the way, as you might imagine. And maybe that's something that's more common in England, which is kind of funny about its food anyway, than it is in Australia. But one thing it did show, I think, was that all these people who had these eating disorders were pretty much alienated from the process of growing food and the process of where we get our food from. And a large part of the therapy to treat it was to take them to a farm and get people to bury their fingers into soil and to grow something and then eat it themselves, a thing that they couldn't possibly have contemplated eating in the past. Do you think that's a common problem, that we're alienated from the way too many people in modern life are alienated from process of making food?
Oh, exactly. That's what motivates me, that we illustrate that difference between living produce and dead products. And when you draw that simple line and you ask yourself that every time you go to put something to your mouth, it changes the way you look at the world. And then, oh, well, look at that. Here, grab that. That's
yeah, you're handing me a mandarin.
Peel that open.
Smells
that's
great.
That's a totally biodynamic mandarin that was grown on my friend's property in Tamworth. And she gave that to me last week. I said to the kids at school today, I said, if you eat living things, what does it make you? And their answer, more living. And I said, if you eat dead things that are in a packet that's sealed with no air and that they're full of preservative, I said, what does it make you? And they said, more deader. So, you know, I mean, that I have to... Part of my day-to-day and week-to-week is explaining concepts to kids in a way that they can take it on board. And I use the same explanations with adults anyway.
Costa, it's been such a pleasure talking to you and fantastic to feel your enthusiasm about this stuff. It's a flagrant violation of ABC editorial policy, but I'm going to insist from now on that future guests of this program bring me fresh fruit like this, as you have just done. It's greatly appreciated. Costa, all the best with Gardening Australia. It's been so lovely speaking with you. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Richard, it's been an absolute treat, and thanks for the opportunity.
Beers. Remember when you were 14, your dad taught you to shave. That wasn't a very fatherly way for him to behave. You had to watch your first beard floating down the drain. A beard abandoned, a son betrayed. Your dad taught you how. And look at you now. Cause if your dad doesn't have a beard, you've got two mums, two beardless mums. If your dad doesn't have a beard, you've got two mums, two beardless mums. Remember how you watched your face lathered with cream? The mirror fogging over as the bathroom filled with steam. He put the razor in your hand and said, now let's begin. Shave with short, quick strokes, my son, and head towards the chin. Your dad taught you how. And look at you now. Cause if your dad doesn't have a beard, you've got two mums, two beardless mums. If your dad doesn't have a beard, you've got two mums, two beardless mums.
And that's Adelaide band The Beards, and I couldn't have a conversation with Costa Georgiadis without playing that, could I? That is, if your dad hasn't got a beard, you've got two mums.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.